Imagine what it must feel like to write a song that not only is great, and I mean really great, but also becomes a worldwide mega hit and a signature song for the incomparable Bette Midler. That experience belongs to Amanda McBroom, songwriter of The Rose, and my guest today on Take It From the Top. Just hearing that four-bar intro lifts my spirits. Amanda wrote and performed the song in the mid-1970s, several years before submitting it to be used in the Oscar-nominated film. She won the Golden Globe for Best Original Song in a Motion Picture and has since built a thriving career as a musical storyteller, lyricist, songwriter, and performer. Amanda's soulful lyrics and tuneful music have been recorded by a wide variety of performers, including icons like Barbara Cook, Judy Collins, Betty Buckley, and the Manhattan Transfer. These days, Amanda performs her songs regularly in concert halls and cabaret venues around the world. Amanda joins me today from her home in California. Let's find out what makes Amanda tick and how her love of storytelling, her determination to be truthful, and an unshakable faith in her abilities have taken her to the top. Amanda McBroom, I am so delighted to speak with you today. Thank you for being here.
I am delighted to be here, Dana. Thank you for asking.
When you were a child, Amanda McBroom, what was your favorite book?
Wizard of Oz.
Ooh.
It would be The Wizard of Oz and The Shy Stegosaurus of Cricket Creek.
The Shy Stegosaurus of Cricket Creek.
Yep, started me on my sci-fi path.
And what was it about that? Just the sci-fi that appealed to you, or was there something more?
Well, it was the first time I had ever experienced science fiction. I think I maybe was 6 or 7, something like that. And obviously, between The Wizard of Oz and that, you can see that fantasy played a great deal to do with my young life.
Active imagination, like crazy.
Mm.
Wow. And which of the Oz books did you read? The Wizard of Oz, or did you read all of them?
All of them.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. The Wizard was a nice kickoff, but, you know, once you get into Ozma and stuff like that, it gets really interesting.
So active imagination, was that always easy for you to kind of go into another place?
Yeah, always.
Do you think that it was encouraged from your parents?
Oh, totally. Totally. Come on, my father was an actor, and my mother had been an actress, and she was a drama teacher. So, you know, they were all for, you know, go to the land of what if at all possible times.
If you could play any role, any gender, any age, any vocal range.
Well, let's see. When I was younger, it would have been Billy Bigelow.
Mm-hmm.
But now, I've done Mrs. Lovett, and I love Mrs. Lovett, you know, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. But when I was little, you know, my mother bought all the LPs, the 78 LPs of the Broadway musicals, and so I played them all when I was little, and I was never interested in the women. I wanted to be Rex Harrison. I wanted to be Gordon McRae. You know, I wanted to be John Raitt. You know, those were the songs I liked the most. So, you know, I was in my masculine phase at a very young age.
I'm assuming that My Boy Bill, I mean, who wouldn't want to sing that song, right?
Exactly.
You said your father was an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how that impacted you as a child.
Well, I guess I'd have to say, both of my parents were in love with language.
Mm-hmm.
And we played word games around the table all the time. And my dad and mother were always writing radio plays, and all of his friends who were also actors at the studio. We lived right down the street from Warner Brothers, and they'd come over at night and they'd have their 4 martinis and they'd play word games and do radio dramas in the living room. And I was always allowed to play. I was, you know, the only 4-year-old in pajamas in this group of, you know, serious cigarette-smoking, martini-drinking, acting adults. But I was always allowed into the party. So from early on, they gave me a love of language and a love of, you know, being social with other people and a love of theatrics.
And when was it that you knew, when was it that you really realized that songwriting was something that was...
Oh, that was never in the cards. Never. Acting was it. I started acting and singing when I was 4, you know, in community theater and children's theater and wherever I could act and sing. But songwriting didn't happen until I was in my, oh gosh, late 20s, 30 maybe. And it just happened out of the blue. So that was the hard right turn my career took without, when I wasn't looking. Because that was never my intention.
How did you let that happen? Because, and that's an odd question, I know, but so many people get so single-minded about what it is they are and what they do. How did that...
Well, exactly. And I knew what I was and I knew what I did. But when my husband and I were on the road doing Jacques Brel, and I had a night off and he had a night on, and I had my guitar and I just picked it up, and all of a sudden something was there, and George came home, and I said, I don't know what this is. And he says, oh my God, you just wrote a song and it's good. And it became like a little hobby of mine. I would just sort of twiddle around, 'cause I'd been a folk singer in high school and college, you know, trans-channeling my inner Judy Collins and stuff. And so, I'd always played the guitar and sang along, but I'd never written my own words. And all of a sudden my own words started wanting to come out. But it didn't happen until way, what I would consider late in my career, you know, like 29, 30, late in my career. It wound up that the largest success in my life came from songwriting, much to my amazement.
How did it go from that to winning a Golden Globe and writing a song like The Rose?
Well, The Rose came first. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of in a songwriting phase. And I mean, I'd had The Rose just sitting on a piece of paper for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And when I wrote it, I always played things for my husband. And I said to George, I just wrote this. I don't know what it is. And he looked at me and he said, you just wrote a standard. Mm-hmm. And I said, don't be silly. No one's ever going to hear it. And he said, something is going to happen to this song. And he was very psychic about such things. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years later, I had met this lovely woman, Michelle Brouwerman, who became my, I call her my wife. She and I have been writing songs together since 1974. And she was a professional songwriter. She had, you know, a publisher and all that sort of thing. And she and her writer, co-writer at the time, were submitting songs for a film called The Rose. And she said, you have this song called The Rose. Do you want me to submit it? And I said, sure, because I didn't know my ass from third base as far as submitting a song. So she threw it in with her cassettes and sent it off. And they listened to it, and they sort of said, it might be okay. Mm. Or maybe not, you know, because they were looking for rock and roll. And this was definitely not rock and roll. But the music director, Paul Rothchild, who had been Janis Joplin's music director at one point, said, I think this is the one, and he mailed it to Bette, and she liked it, and then it got in the movie, and then all of a sudden, oh my God, I'm a professional songwriter. But I denied it forever. You know, I just said, no, that was just, and finally my husband said to me, honey, what's paying the mortgage? Don't you think perhaps you should take a little responsibility for this? So then I really had to sit down and have a come to Jesus moment with myself about, am I going to take this more seriously and pursue this? And I have so much fun writing songs. So I just said, well, you know, let's just see what happens. So I was acting on one with my left hand and writing with my right.
I would love to be a fly on the wall when you were having that conversation with yourself. Can you talk a little bit about that? What were the things that you were weighing out?
Well, I just, you know, I knew the world of acting because I'd been doing it since I was, sure, you know, very young. I knew nothing about the world of professional songwriting. I knew nothing about getting a publisher or getting a record deal or getting a record cut or any. I was a total, you know, it's like being thrown into a triathlon when you've barely learned how to ride a tricycle. And so it took me a while to say, am I ready to step into a world I don't know?
Right.
And reluctantly, I got dragged into it.
So that feeling of coming out of your comfort zone.
Exactly.
What were some things that helped you go there? I mean, I'm sure you were making some money at that point. You know, that's
yes.
Helpful, you know.
Very helpful.
You had status.
Well, people loved the song. People had no idea who I was, but right. People really liked the song. Yeah. And when that happened, I had been singing rock and roll. I had a rock and roll band. I was wearing a corset and spandex and singing rock and roll all over Hollywood. And some people wanted me to go and sing in other places, and I realized I couldn't take a band with me. I couldn't afford a band, but I could afford Michelle, but that meant it was me and a piano, which means not so much rock and roll. So that's what started cabaret for me, was people were starting to ask me to sing in clubs, but without a drummer and a guitarist, what's the point of a corset? So I found a tuxedo, you know, and started singing my songs in a cabaret setting. I was never a cabaret artist as you think of a traditional cabaret artist, which is someone who's doing Noel Coward and Gershwin and Johnny Mercer and Harold Arlen. And it was just my excuse to sing my own songs. And fortunately, most of my songs are kind of, well, they're little, I call them little movies. So it was nice to have a place where I could sing my little movies.
I love that description because, you know, when you said that, I go, yes, they are, because that's what always strikes me about your songs is that...
I'm a storyteller. I realize, you know, it's shades of Jacques Brel, shades of Harry Chapin, shades of... I'm just I love to set stories to music. And musical trends come and go, and in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and the 60s, 70s, telling stories was a big deal. Once you got into the 80s, it got to be a lot more about the groove and dancing and the hook. And so I've never been a pop. I'm not a pop writer. I'm always astounded when somebody from the pop world wants to cut some of my material, which is delightful, and I say thank you very much. But they obviously choose it as the one weird song on their album. Album, CD, whatever. Not even CD anymore. Spotify. I don't know.
On their playlist.
Yes, on their playlist. Thank you.
So it is something that just sort of has evolved for you over the
Totally. I had no plan, no instruction manual. I've had a few dear friends who've gently pushed me in certain directions, and that's it. I've been very, very lucky flying by the seat of my well-worn pants.
If you could go back to that, you know, the young lady in the, I guess you were in a hotel room with your guitar.
Yes.
If you could go back to her right now, you know, and give her some advice, what would you tell her?
Aside from, are you sure? I would have to say, have faith in yourself.
Mm.
You have a talent, because I didn't know, I knew that I enjoyed doing it, but I didn't know the impact that my songs would have on people. Mm. And I've always danced the dance between humility and false humility. You know, trying not to be so humble as to get in your own way without tooting your horn so loudly that, you know, people put their hands to their ears.
Oh,
and I was always very, very reticent about how good my material was. And now I realize that it's good. I'm proud of what I do. So I should, you know, that's what I would say is this is really good. Don't give up on it.
You mentioned something that really perked up my ears because I don't know how many people are aware of how detrimental false humility can be. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, and I don't know where it came from, but I find that there's a great deal to be said for true humility, as long as it doesn't paralyze you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I personally believe that the really good things I write come from somewhere else.
Mm.
I consider myself a vehicle for things that want to come through, the really good ones. Mm-hmm. And the rest of them are serviceable and journeyman and work, and God bless them. Some of those are really good too. But I feel that the creativity comes from somewhere else. So I can't take full responsibility for it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, just saying, that thing about, oh, no, I'm not really good, while you're saying, come on, tell me I'm good. Tell me I'm good. You know, that's
right.
You know, perverse.
What is true humility?
I think it's knowing your place on the ladder, which is not to say not wanting to go higher, not wanting to do better, not wanting to be, because I'm certainly ambitious, but it's also knowing that I'm not God, and it's not brain surgery, and I haven't saved any lives today. To try to put myself in perspective and be proud of the gift and proud of the instrument, but not so proud as to be blind to what else is better.
What are some techniques you use that help you keep that all in perspective for yourself?
Listen to other great people. You know, go watch Ann Hampton Callaway do an evening in a theater somewhere. Listen to Barbara Cook sing a song.
Or sing your song.
Or sing my song, yeah, with such brilliance. Finding the people that make you go, oh, my God, I wish I could be you.
And realizing it doesn't take anything away from you.
Exactly.
I add that in there. If anything, it makes me better, right?
Exactly. You know, that's I learned that one long ago about be on stage with someone who's better than you are.
Oh, my God.
Work with someone that you consider better than you are, because that's the only way you're going to learn to rise up.
You also just spoke about that you're a vehicle and that it doesn't really come from you. Where does it come from, Amanda?
Whatever the divine creative, wherever that is, the creative zeitgeist, wherever it might be, in the sky, in the higher self, I don't know, but I truly do believe that I have the tools. I know language. I know storytelling. But the really good stories appear without my searching for them. They just appear. My propensity in writing is to write okay, one of my favorite songs, which very few people have ever heard, was written, there was a few years back, there was a massacre at a McDonald's. I don't know if you remember, but a guy went in and shot like 12 people dead in a McDonald's.
I do remember.
And I remember reading that and thinking, what must his wife feel? So I had to write a song from her perspective. And it's a really terrific song. But I'm always sort of going to, what does this person feel and what would they say? So it's like writing little monologues. It's the people on the periphery whose stories are the most interesting. You know, not Donald Trump, but one of his daughters. She's interesting.
I noticed that, and I actually had the privilege of hearing you sing some of a number or two, I think, from A Woman of Will.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Can you talk to me a little bit of that? Sounds like that. What a wonderful, rich source of.
Oh my God, that was delicious. And I keep thinking, if I want another project, I have to find another book as much fun as the Folios of Shakespeare. I had written a song for Ophelia. I was sitting at a friend's piano. I think it was Martha's Vineyard, and I looked at there was this painting of this little girl standing in a river in a little Victorian dress and sort of looking down the river. And I said, oh my God, that's Ophelia before the shit hits the fan. And what would Ophelia say? And then that song came out, and then I thought, well, that's fun. And then I thought, what would Hamlet's mother say if she was responding to Hamlet yelling at her about the fact that she's in love with somebody else? And it just became, and then it was, what would Catherine the Shrew say? What would Lady Macbeth say? And I wound up writing this cycle of songs for Shakespeare's women. It was really fun because it wasn't like I had to scrounge through the invisible ethers to find inspiration. There were all these women. Okay, great.
You have to choose what not to do, really.
Exactly.
What to you is success?
What to me is success?
Mm-hmm.
I would say, as my husband always says, the respect of my peers. I think I am in a wonderful place because I think fame is horrendous. I watch what people who are super famous, you know, the Brad and Angelinas and the Taylor Swifts and the people, and the horrible, horrible weight of that kind of fame. And I think it is so much more a curse than a blessing. And I can go to the store and nobody knows who the hell I am, and that's just wonderful. But still, people, you know, when I perform, I have fans who love what I do and seem to find it healing in a naughty world, and that's just fabulous. So I think respect and enough people to fill a room when you sing.
The best of everything. It's the best of everything.
I think so. I absolutely think so. I mean, you know, if I go to a theater in New York to go see a play, the ticket person will smile and say, "Oh, hello, Miss McBroom." That blows my mind. You know, that people know who I am, but it's not like anybody. No, there's no paparazzi on the street are going to shoot me. So, in any sense of the word, but so it's great.
I just gave you a billboard. Okay.
Okay.
I did.
Thank you.
I knew you'd play along. I just gave you a billboard, and it's going to be in Times Square.
Mm-hmm.
You know, millions of people are going to see this daily, probably.
Oh, my. Mm-hmm.
And it's going to impact their lives. What would you say on that billboard?
Oh, baby, you ask some questions, don't you? Just remember, in the winter, far beneath the bitter snows lies the seed that with the sun's love in the spring becomes the rose.
Mm. Wow. First of all, I just heard Amanda McBroom speak her lyric, and it really touched me. What a beautiful, hopeful thing to tell people.
Absolutely. I believe it.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for that wonderful, that's such a cool question.
I wasn't ready for that, but you know, you really got me. If you could say, and I'm going to move on, but you know, just let you know that really hit me. What other advice could you give someone who would like to do what you do?
The first thing is truth. If you're going to create anything, even if it's a fantasy, the first thing is you have to tell the truth. You have to have confidence in your story. If you're fortunate enough to have someone who is eyes and a heart that you trust, who can say, yeah, this is going a little, you know, just lower Slabovia, you know, pull it the other way. But, you know, you did an interview with my darling Bill Castellino, which mm-hmm. is how you and I met. And mm-hmm. Bill was that person for me when we were doing Heartbeats together, to have mm-hmm. someone I trusted completely because his knowledge was so good and he was so kind and he could say, this is wrong, this is right. But still knowing in my gut, having faith in your own creation, because everybody is going to tell you that you should either change it or that it's no good. Mm-hmm. I say we all carry on our shoulder this little person in a judge's robe. I don't know how we get that person, and I know that that person has a protective service to perform, but that person is also the one that says, that's a piece of shit. You shouldn't mm-hmm. do that. Don't do that. And, you know, you have to say, thank you for sharing. Now go have a glass of wine somewhere because I have to create now. So being able to ignore the judge that sits on your shoulder is a fierce one.
Mm-hmm.
The one that wants perfection, the one that wants it done fast,
mm-hmm.
the one that says, you know, if it's not going to make a million, you know, if you start from, I want to make $1 million, you shouldn't be in the arts.
Right. You're describing a whole committee there, not just the judge.
Yeah. it's the Supreme Court.
I know. And you described a beautiful, elegant way to deal. You know, it's just thank you very much, but go have a glass of wine. I love that.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to remember that next time I hear that that little committee going crazy.
Just that, knowing that there's a purpose to it, but this is not its purpose.
Sure. Yeah.
Excellent. If you create, you can't have judgment when you start creating. You got to have chaos when you start creating. Later on, you can pull the judge back in to neaten and tidy things up, but you got to have the chaos first.
Creating is messy, isn't it?
Oh, it's terribly messy. It's messy and it's bloody and it's scary and it's exciting and it's wonderful. It's everything. It's chaos and it's incredibly brave.
It does take a lot of courage, doesn't it?
Well, the writing for me wasn't the brave thing. Singing my own stuff, when I first started singing my own stuff, was absolutely terrifying. Because it's, of course, saying, here's my soul, all you strange people that I don't know, what do you think?
Right.
Not knowing whether people are going to say, oh, what a piece of do you are. Or, yes, I can dig that. You don't know when you first start out.
Amanda McBroom, my goodness, you model true humility at every turn, and man, you can fill a room.
Bless your heart.
And you can move us very deeply with what you do. I'm so, so glad you're in the world, and thank you for sharing this time with me today.
Dana, thank you. This was, you made me sit down and think, which I needed to do, and I so appreciate it. You're adorable.
Oh, thank you. Thank you
so honey.
Much.
Thank you.
Side effects from listening to Take It From the Top include climbing out of a creative rut, getting inspired, and or living the life of your dreams. If these symptoms persist, tell a friend to download the podcast immediately.